Michael Grunwald's book, The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise, came out of newspaper series he wrote as a reporter for The Washington Post, on the Everglades and on the Army Corps of Engineers. According to Grunwald, pretty much anyone in South Florida who's living west of I-95, the north-south highway running only a few miles from the East Coast, lives on land that once was part of the former Everglades. That's several million people living in a place that early explorers once compared unfavorably to hell. The Swamp explains the unique ecosystem of the Everglades. It recounts all the wars fought between natives and would-be settlers over the vast wetlands, and all the industrial-era efforts to tame, drain, and develop the river of grass known as the Everglades. The book begins with the passage of the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, a multi-billion-dollar environmental cleanup bill passed by Congress 6 years ago. The bill hands the work of saving what's left of the Everglades to the Army Corps of Engineers, the same group that became famous and infamous in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Describe the Everglades to people who have never been there, both the basic boundaries of it and what you're likely to find inside there.
You know, I always like to say about the Everglades that it's kind of less ooh and ah than hmm. You know, it's not the Grand Canyon and it's not Yellowstone National Park. And the guidebooks, they're still always warning tourists. They have these great euphemisms. They say the Everglades takes some getting used to, or it reveals its secrets slowly. You know, its appeal may escape many visitors at first glance, which is a kind of kind way of saying that you're not going to see, you know, giant mountains and rugged cliffs and you know, craters and geysers. It looks like a meadow, or a or a very wet and wet tundra. It's essentially a river of grass. It's the slowest moving and widest river in the world, and it flows essentially from Lake Okeechobee, or it did in its natural state, which is in the center of peninsula, all the way down to Florida Bay and the 10,000 Islands. And it was just this broad sheet of gently flowing water going through the sawgrass. It could look kind of monotonous. It had these sort of teardrop-shaped islands with trees on it, and had plenty of wildflowers. And, it had royal palms and panthers and gators and otters. It's the only place on Earth where you'll find crocodiles and alligators side by side. But essentially, it was water and it was grass. But it is at first glance, you wouldn't necessarily say this was this is a national park. You see plenty of tourists out there saying, like, is this it?
Michael, this book grew out of a series that you did for The Washington Post, which grew out of a previous series that you had done for The Washington Post on the Army Corps of Engineers. At what point did you visit the Everglades for the first time?
You know, I went in August 2000. I was writing a series about the Army Corps and investigating how they were cooking the books of their economic studies in order to justify boondoggles that usually had really serious environmental consequences. Mm-hmm. And I had heard that, you know, the Corps had helped to destroy the Everglades, and now the Corps was in charge of this great project to restore it. So I thought that might be a nice way to cap the series, to write about the possible future of this agency that in the past was better known for dams and dikes and dredges. So I went in August 2000, and it was hot. There were bugs. And, it was wet and nasty.
I can say as a former resident of Florida that August in Florida is no paradise by any means.
But I did start to, I had some very good tour guides who explained to me, kind of how the Everglades works, which is, one of the really cool things about it. When you start to see, there are all these species that don't seem to belong on the same continent, much less the same ecosystem. You know, how can a panther and a hammerhead shark be in the same place? What I also started to realize was that this restoration project was a lot more complicated than I had thought. In Washington, it had just been sold to us as kind of like, hurrah, we're saving the Everglades, so let's all sing kumbaya. But in fact, this $8 billion, now up to nearly $11 billion project, is much more complicated. It's a water supply project that's supposed to provide water for another 6 million people to move to South Florida, mm-hmm. For the sugar industry, for real estate. And it's supposed to provide some for the Everglades too. But what I found is that the benefits for economic interests are really swift and sure in this project, but the benefits for the Everglades were delayed for decades and highly uncertain. And in fact, I came back a couple of years later and decided to do an entire project, entire series for the Post that was just on this restoration project.
Mm-hmm. The Swamp, the Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise is the title of your book, and it sort of gives the various chunks of the book. There's the history of the state in geographic and geological and biographical terms. And then there's all of the wars between European settlers and natives. And then when American colonialists came in and the whole claim for the state. And then once the state is established, there's the development and exploitation of the state. And then after environmental disaster after disaster, then opportunities and chances to try and reclaim it. And at every single stage, there's politics and there's people and there's all sorts of amazing characters. And I don't know, as you went around researching the various chunks of this, which one surprised you the most and which one was hardest to wrestle to the ground?
Well, thank you so much for your kind words. I mean, I really did. I saw this as a story. It's a very important story, I think. I think the Everglades is kind of the ultimate test of sustainable development. But most of all, I was really drawn to it because it's such a gripping story. The Everglades was really America's last frontier. And I didn't realize that in 1880, the census for Dade County, which at that point was most of South Florida, the equivalent of about 5 million people today, it was 257. So that was one of the real surprising things, was tracking the transformation of the frontier. I mean, frontier stories, that's where the action is. I was also really shocked by, that we all have a sense that kind of, man's relationship with nature has changed, that we used to think about taming nature and now we want to work more in harmony with nature. But I had no idea that it was the conservationists who were the most aggressive about taming nature. The drainage of the Everglades, which has had such disastrous environmental consequences, was a conservation project when it was first started. My favorite character in the book is Governor Napoleon Bonaparte Broward. You hear about Broward County. Well, this was a guy who was as colorful as his name. He had a crazy Horatio Alger childhood, later became a gun runner for Cuban revolutionaries, and then became governor of Florida by running on a platform where his top priority was to save the Everglades.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he didn't mean to save it from drainage or development. He meant to save it from oblivion. He was a conservationist, a guy who wanted to protect fish, protect birds, and turn this great wasteland, which is what wetlands were considered in those days, into really productive land, something that people could use. That was really what conservationism was all about. It was the opposite of waste, the wise use of natural resources. Everybody remembers, particularly in Florida, where people seem to multiply a lot, that God told us to be fruitful and multiply, but they forget the rest of the quote, which is, and replenish the earth and subdue it and take dominion over the fish of the sea and the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. So back then, exploiting nature was not just man's right. It was man's duty. It was God's work. And that was something I didn't understand before I buried myself in the archives.
One of the things that's most striking about your history, because you stop being a reporter and start being a historian when you put it between hard covers, is that you are sort of forgiving of a lot of different sides and a lot of different political viewpoints in different eras, that, you sort of accept manifest destiny. You sort of accept the various driving forces that were accepted at the time. And was that an original approach that you took from square one, or was it when you were collecting everything and trying to make sense of it?
Well, as I got to know these characters, it was different from journalism, where when I'm reporting a story for The Washington Post, I'm talking to people who are living in the same era as I am. But as I was, reporting on somebody like Napoleon Bonaparte Broward or Henry Flagler or someone from another era, I started to feel that it was really unfair to judge them by the standards of our day, that I really had to put them in context. You know, you take somebody like John Gifford, who was the great Florida conservationist of the early 1900s. He was actually the editor of a national magazine called Conservation. And he called the Everglades Drainage Project the greatest conservation project of its day. Mm-hmm. And he imported these seeds from Australia of a tree called Melaleuca, which he thought would be a natural swamp tree because it was a very thirsty tree and it kind of sucks the wet right out of wetlands. And he planted a few over by Biscayne Bay and a little bit by the town of Davie. And today, 100 years later, there are 1 million acres of Melaleuca in the Everglades. It is a weed. It is, you know, everybody hates it.
Yeah.
But John Gifford didn't know that. You know, he was trying to help. So I try not to be too judgmental about guys like that.
Talk a little bit about the history of the draining of the Everglades, the very first time that people went in and wanted to claim the bottom half of Florida and use it for their own purposes.
Well, it originally was supposed to begin, right in the 1840s. And there was a guy named David Levy Yulee who had sort of led Florida into statehood with this great socialist vision of a railroad, state-owned railroad across the state. But it turned out he decided once he got power that a better idea would be a Yulee-owned railroad across the state. And instead of Florida spending the next couple of decades focusing on draining the Everglades, state government ended up spending up most of its time promoting David Yulee's railroad, which ended up being a really great thing for the Everglades. It preserved it for another generation. Then in the 1880s, a Yankee industrialist named Hamilton Diston, he had inherited a factory from his dad, and he really wanted to get out of his dad's shadow, came down to Florida on a fishing trip. And he saw what so many others saw, this deep black soil, this gorgeous climate, this bountiful rain. You know, all you had to do was just get rid of that water, just drain it off. And, you know, water runs downhill. So he thought that would be a piece of cake. But 15 years later, he didn't really get the job done. Henry Flagler, the great developer who he was John Rockefeller's partner at Standard Oil, he considered draining the Everglades, and this guy had the money to do it. He was one of the richest men of his era. But at the last minute, he decided that he was going to focus instead on his railroads and hotels, and he ultimately built a railroad all the way to Key West through the ocean. And he was willing to do that. He spent the equivalent of $500 million on it, but he fortunately didn't turn his considerable energies to draining the Everglades. And then finally, Napoleon Bonaparte Broward really got the program going in the early 1900s. He was a great conservationist, a progressive, and drainage was the hallmark of progress. He thought he could save the Everglades by, not from drainage and development, but from oblivion.
Let's talk about the politics of paradise for a minute here. As Florida develops, as various interests want to get down there with railroads and for sugarcane and for everything else, talk about how important it is, some of the other things that were going on in the country that affected Florida. You mentioned specifically the National Park Service when it was established in 1916 and things that you would think at first blush wouldn't have a lot to do with the Everglades but turned out to be crucial.
Well, Everglades National Park was started in 1947. It was the first national park established for biology rather than just its scenery. And it really represented an understanding that you couldn't just, it was one thing to sort of stop hunters from killing birds or stop fishers from overfishing, that you really had to protect a sense of place. And that led, but of course at the same time, the Army Corps of Engineers was getting going with its Central and Southern Florida project, which has contributed so much to the decline of the Everglades. Though at the time, again, conservationists saw no conflict between the two whatsoever. There wasn't that kind of understanding that the things that happen outside the borders of a national park can affect what goes on inside. Because the Everglades is essentially a water park. What made the Everglades work was water. used to flow, the ecosystem really began in Orlando, what's now Orlando, and flowed all the way down to the coral reefs off the Keys. And the lifeblood was this clean, fresh, gently flowing water. And, you know, the story of the last 100 years is how we've dammed and diked and diverted that water and how we've developed half of the Everglades. Today, half of it's gone and the other half is an ecological mess.
So if clean water is so important to the Everglades, you have the Clean Water Act of 1972. Is that a big tipping point or a turning point in the history of the Glades?
Well, you know, the late 60s and early 70s are a really important time because there was this sort of national awakening to this notion that we were essentially fouling our own nests. This was a time when that river caught fire in Cleveland. The
yes.
bald eagle, the symbol of America, almost went extinct. And there was this kind of understanding that, you know, you don't have to be this kind of eco-freak to care about, you know, the air that we breathe, the water we drink, the, you know, the landscapes we like, the fisheries that feed us. And, you know, that's been in Florida, there's been a real sense that the development of the Everglades has continued, there have been terrible impacts for people. I mean, first with Broward's canals, you know, in the dry season, they carried out the water and pretty soon the swamp was on fire. You had the very muck soil that had attracted these settlers to the Everglades in the first place was drying up and blowing away. The drinking wells that, you know, the aquifers for most of South Florida sit right underneath the Everglades and they had terrible saltwater intrusion. And now in modern times, you're starting to see an extension of that, that as we've sprawled into the Everglades, not only are you losing the ecotourism industries and the, you know, the fisheries and, you know, the diving over by the Keys, but that you're also – you're finding Floridians are spending their time sitting in traffic, that their schools are overcrowded. You know, in Broward County, kids have to start lining up for lunch at 9:50 in the morning. That Florida kind of began to lose its sense of place, that the things that made Florida, Florida were gone and that this wasn't the reason people had moved there. So that really is what has created, to the extent there's been a political backlash against the destruction of the Everglades. It's as we've realized that what hurts the bugs and bunnies isn't always good for us.
In the 6 years since the $8 million comprehensive Everglades restoration plan was passed, what was that supposed to do, and how much of it has it done so far?
Well, it's essentially supposed to restore some semblance of the natural Everglades. And obviously, you can't entirely restore it. That would be like restoring the omelet you ate for breakfast to its egg. you know, there's a lot you can do to try to recreate that flow. What they're always talking about is getting the water right. Get it in the right amounts and the right places with the right quality and at the right timing. Unfortunately, the news the last few years has not been very good. In fact, I write about this one Army Corps memo where the guy overseeing the project in Washington says, we're only 5 years in. We're already way behind schedule, over budget, and this isn't restoration at all.
And since the book has been published, are you keeping tracks on it, like checking in on a critically ill patient to see how the Glades are doing?
Absolutely. And I think it is a quagmire. You're kind of stuck for life. You know, I really think that, you know, this restoration project is hugely important, not just for Florida, but really for the world. I mean, South Florida is where we're going to figure out whether man can live in harmony with nature. I mean, this project is being watched in the Chesapeake Bay, the Great Lakes, Louisiana's coastal wetlands. I spoke to the guy who's in charge of trying to restore the Garden of Eden marshes that Saddam Hussein destroyed in southern Iraq. And he says he's paying careful attention to what goes on in the Everglades, that's a model for him. You know, the Everglades, where you've got this unbelievable political support all across the spectrum. You know, you've got the world's most beloved wetland, the world's most intensely studied wetland. You've got, you know, plenty of rain, and you know, you've got plenty of science, not to mention plenty of money. You really have to wonder, if you can't save the Everglades and its ecosystem, what are you going to save?
All right. Well, Michael, thank you very much. Thanks for coming on Fresh Air.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Michael Grunwald, reporter for The Washington Post. His book is The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise.